You're listening to a talk presented by the Brisbane City Bible Forum. Thank you for listening.
We couldn't get the... we had a laptop failure, so I had a picture of this young, poor girl, but couldn't show it. In October 2011, I don't know if you heard about this in the news, a surveillance camera that was near some markets in the southern province of China showed a two-year-old girl being run over by a delivery van. Her name was Wang Yu. People then rushed to her aid. Actually, no, they didn't. The camera then shows 18 people walking past her. And then another delivery van ran over her legs. And then a rubbish collector dragged her to the side of the road. And he was hailed a national hero for moving her off the road. The Chinese internet, I think it's called Weibo, a micro-blogging. There was a lot of soul-searching about that. Ask the question, doesn't it? I imagine those 18 people who walked by and the van drivers, I suspect, were probably later shocked by their own callousness when they stopped to think about it, by their lack of goodness. But ask the question, isn't it? Why is it so hard to do good? The presupposition of our society and culture is that we are good. But if we're so good, why is it so hard to do good? If we were naturally good, why wouldn't we just default to doing the good thing, even if it costs to ourselves? But is that what we do? Rather, don't we have to work quite hard to be good? Doing the self-interested, selfish, or even wicked thing comes so much more naturally. If we were truly, fundamentally, 100% good, it ought to come as easy as breathing or sleeping or eating. Occasionally we do good. Let's recognise that. Especially in times of disaster or tragedy, it seems like the magnitude of the scale of the disaster helps us rise above our self-interest and, you know, take the Mud Army in Brisbane or volunteers when there's an earthquake or landslide. But mostly that's not what we see, is it, in ourselves or others. The good that we want to do, it's so bad that the good that we want to do, we so often don't do it, do we? And the bad things that we don't want to do, we actually find ourselves doing them. Are we really so very good? What about me? Well, when I was about 18 and I was on a bus and I was about a third of the way down from the front of the bus, a man got on, I don't remember if he got on with this woman, and he started yelling abuse at this woman who was sitting right up the front, really yelling at her abusively, calling her offensive, awful names. I didn't know what to do. I was a young 18, 19-year-old man, boy. Should I intervene? There were a bunch of people sitting closer to them than me, none of them seemed to be doing anything. And I stood there thinking, you know, do I do something? Do I not? When's the right time to intervene? I hope that the driver would do something. He would pull over, or in a stop or two, the woman just got off and the man got off and he kept yelling at her and then she kept walking away and it kind of seemed to dissipate. I got off in the city, another 3/4 of a kilometre down the road. I was shaken, I was a little ashamed, and then a man got off the bus behind me, and he said to me, as he walked past, and I won't repeat the first word that he used, but the second word was coward, and he said it to me as he walked past. He was sitting just 2 seats behind me, but he called me a coward, a ... coward. I'd failed. So had he. And yet he'd use my failure to justify his own failure. That's how not good we are, isn't it? We're so not good that what we actually have to do is look at someone else's failings to say, well, I'm better than them. But as soon as you've had to make that move, it's a capitulation, isn't it? That we're not good, that we have to look to someone who's failed to justify ourselves. Why is it so hard for us to do good and be good? Is there a way out of this failure? this lack of goodness? Is there hope for our hearts? Well, Jesus gives us the answer, and it's actually quite a shocking answer. It's actually discovering where the problem really is. And it unfolds in an argument with the religious leaders. And it's in that passage that Mark read out for us. See, the religious leaders, this is the first kind of main point of the passage, they've got an issue with Jesus. They come to Jesus, and they come to him to discover that Jesus' disciples don't follow the religious rules. And we're halfway through Mark's gospel. We've already seen Jesus breaking religious rules in the first few chapters, healing on the Sabbath, doing a bunch of things that upset the religious teachers. But now it's kind of escalating because these disciples are doing it as well. Well, they did it earlier a little bit. Chapter 7 and then sentence 5 there. So the Pharisees and teachers of the law asked Jesus, "Why don't your disciples live according to the tradition of the elders instead of eating their food with defiled hands?" So the disciples having a meal, they hadn't washed their hands, they hadn't kept the rules. Why don't you keep the religious traditions? But Jesus, if they have an issue with Jesus, well, Jesus has an issue with them. And the sharp point in that passage read out for us is seen in sentence 8. It says, Jesus said to them, "You have let go of the commands of God and are holding on to human traditions." Why is it that my disciples don't keep your traditions? Because they're the traditions of men. And he gives an example. Sentence 9. He continued, "You have a fine way of setting aside the commands of God, the very commands of God, in order to observe your own traditions." And then he points to the word of God that was given when the nation of Israel was formed at Mount Sinai. And one of the commandments was, "Honor your father and mother." For Moses said, sentence 10. But then another part of the text he quotes, "And anyone who curses their father or mother is to be put to death." Explored a bit later than the giving of the Ten Commandments. These commandments, they were no mere, I don't know how you hear the word commandments, but this was no mere if you like it. Cursing your parents deserves death. Why? Well, because I think parents were under God as the givers and guardians of life. So to reject them was rejecting their role as the givers and guardians of life, and therefore to reject God. But the Jews had a tradition. This is where Jesus kind of points it out to them. Sentence 11. "But you say that if anyone declares that what might have been used to help their father or mother is korban, that is a gift devoted to God, then you no longer let them do anything for their father or mother." So it's unclear. So there's this thing called korban. It's a gift to God. It's unclear whether that means a son. So, you know, there's no financial, there's no security system, there's no old age pension. A son had the role of, children had the role of providing for their parents, looking after them in their old age or in their need, even if it was old age, and just generally caring for them. So what it seems like is a son can say, "Well, this thing, money that I should have given to you, I get to declare it korban." Now, it's unclear whether it's he could give the money to the temple and declare it korban and now he doesn't have access to it, or whether he can call it korban, and he can use it for himself until such time as he gives it to the temple. It seems that both were possibilities. So it's not just that he doesn't have the money. He's got it. But he doesn't have to use it for his parents. So, think about this. There's a capital offence, an offence punishable by death, if you don't honour your parents, or if you curse them. And he's saying, you've let go of that. Denying that capital offence is permitted by the Pharisaic law, by the Pharisees' law. But it's not just that it's even permitted. It's required. It's required. See what it says in sentence 12? "Then you no longer let them do anything for their father or mother." It wasn't just that for the standard Jew, the Israelite, this was a way of getting out. This was something enforced by the religious leaders. You're not allowed to give that to your parents. You're not allowed to give that to your parents. He says, you no longer let him do anything for his father or mother. So I don't know quite how big the scope of Korban is, but Jesus thinks it's pretty terrible. You no longer let him do anything for his father or mother. What's the outcome of this? Jesus uses a very strong word, sentence 13. Thus you nullify the word of God by your tradition that you have handed down. Here's this tradition, and you deliberately pass it on, and you make the word of God zero. Nullify. You give it no power, no effectiveness. Sentence 13, and you do many things like that. This is just Jesus' sharp example of a whole host of things. Now, this isn't an accidental issue with true religion. This is a deliberate replacing of God's word with man's ideas. It's deliberate. And this is always a disaster. I think two prime examples of that is when religious organizations have decided that it's more holy to be unmarried than it is to be married. The Bible never says that. It never says that celibacy is closer to God. It says,
Paul recommends it, though.
He says, yeah. He says, singleness gives you great benefits. Singleness enables, frees you up to serve people. But he never says you're more holy. Just think. Now, I know that marriage, and we talked about this in the Church Abuse series, I know that marriage doesn't solve all of the problems in sexual brokenness or sexual power. Let's be clear. But imagine the horror that would have been avoided if some denominations hadn't nullified the word of God at that point. But let me give a broader example. You see, there's a writer, his name's Gascoigne. He works for the Department of History at the University of New South Wales. And he's written a book about the Enlightenment origins in Australia. So as Australia came into being, how did Enlightenment principles affect that? And what he shows, one of the shocking things he shows, is that initially, I guess the Christian heritage that was brought over from England held sway in the colony. And so this idea was the Aboriginal people ought to be protected and guarded. Why? Because they too were made in the image of God. But as Enlightenment ideas came to the fore, ideas underpinned by evolutionary theory kind of pushed their way into the colony, which they did. The Aboriginal people, instead of being seen as being made in the image of God, were seen as a dying race of lesser humans. They weren't as far progressed as us because they were further down the evolutionary tree. And so what was the job of the white man then? Well, he was to provide a pillow for this dying race of Aboriginal people. And it's that kind of thinking that led to the rise of even the Stolen Generation. And the taking of children from mixed heritage, because there was some hope for those mixed children who came from two races. There was some hope for them, so we take them out of that context and put them into a civilized context. Imagine the horror that would have been avoided. Now, yes, the church was culpable at that point. They helped look after those children that were taken away. They were involved in taking the children. And so the church is culpable there in many ways. But the government was just looking for some agents who could do the work for them. It was actually policy of the Australian government. Helped, probably implemented by the churches, but it was a policy of the Australian government. Why? Because of Enlightenment principles. So imagine, you might not believe in a creator God. So you kind of think, what's all this argument about? Imagine for a moment, there is a creator God. You might not believe in him, but imagine for a moment, he is there and he existed. Imagine then, because of who he is and his goodness, that he told his creatures how to live, how they could find their purpose and their meaning, what goodness looked like, how they could honor him. If a creator, an all-powerful being, who was good, gave this information to his creatures, why wouldn't they want to listen to it? I don't know if you've ever thought about that. I think it's a shocking thought. Why would Why would these creatures not listen? Is it an inability to listen? Why would people explicitly reject what the Creator God has said? Well, because we have an issue with our heart. Our actual hearts, the very center of our will and person, despise God. Look what Jesus says. Listen to Jesus' words and the challenge to the religious leaders. He says this in Mark chapter 7, verse 6, at the start of his argument. They come to him and say, "Why do your disciples eat with defiled hands?" He quotes the prophet Isaiah and he says, "Isaiah was right when he prophesied about you hypocrites. Those people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me." See, religious people, they honor God with their lips, but their hearts are far. For those of us sitting in this room, that's a searing critique we should hear. It's very easy to honor God with our lips, but our hearts be far.
I have a little table on the wall to get to heaven for all my good deeds on that side and my bad deeds on that one, so that when I get to the top, I'm in heaven.
Yeah, that's right.
Isn't that how it works?
Yeah. Whereas non-religious people, their hearts are far from God as well, but at least they're not hypocrites. They don't honor God with their lips. They're kind of one step ahead. Whereas the religious people are self-deceptive. That's why Jesus uses such strong words from Isaiah. People honor me with their lips. They talk the talk, but their hearts are far from me. The problem for both religious and non-religious people is their hearts are far from God. Now, you might not believe there's a creator God, but just again, for a moment, imagine that there is one. Can you see what a great tragedy this is? Can you imagine a daughter or a son who will not talk to, who will not acknowledge their parents, a 12 or 13-year-old son or daughter, accepts their food and their care and their love, but never recognizes it, never hugs their parents, never acknowledges their provision, never thanks them for the good they do. Now, if you've got teenage children, you might be thinking, what's a standard issue? That is a standard issue. And what is it like? It's awful, isn't it? It's awful. That's the picture the Bible presents. God made this world a paradise. The goodness is overwhelming. That's why we've got so many travel shows. The goodness is overwhelming. That's why we've got so many food shows. Even in a broken world, there's so much goodness. The atheists say, the world that you look at is so chaotic and so terrible and such a disaster that that's exactly the world you'd expect if there wasn't a God. Really? Really? I actually think, why are the tragedies that happen, the earthquakes, the disasters, the very recent death of my father, why are they tragedies? Because they stand out starkly, because actually there is so much goodness. There is rain sent on crops all over the world. There is food all over the world. There are a bazillion cooking shows on the Australian television because of the abundance of food in the Western world. There are hospitals and doctors and trained medical staff such that when someone has poor treatment, it is a tragedy. God made this world a paradise, now a broken one, but a paradise. His character, his goodness have seeped through, love for his creatures, provision. And what are his creatures like? Our hearts are far from him. And the problem with this distance of our hearts, it has terrible consequences for our hearts. We can't walk away from the creator of goodness without that having a profound problem for our hearts. See, our hearts being far from God means our hearts have deep, 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 dark issues. Look at what Jesus says later on, chapter 7, in his time chapter, in verse 17. After he left the crowd and entered the house, his disciples asked him about this parable. Because Jesus had said, nothing outside a person could defile them by going into them. Rather, it's what comes out of a person that defiles them. That is what Jesus said. And they said, what were you talking about, Jesus? What do you mean the outside doesn't defile you, but what comes, you know, what comes inside from the outside? Isn't that vomit? That's defiling, isn't it? Well, they're really confused. Jesus, are you so dull? I think it's a rhetorical question. The answer is yes. Are you so dull? The answer is yes. Don't you see that nothing that enters a man from outside can make him unclean? Why? For it doesn't go into his heart, but into his stomach and out of his body. Basically saying the digestive system, a piece of general physiology, he's talking about it to make a spiritual point, the digestive system, you know, you eat this food, it gets digested, it goes into the latrine. The heart, for the Jew, was the centre of their will, centre of their mind, centre of the person. Saying, where does food go? The toilet. Does it go into the heart? Now, don't talk to me about nutrients being picked up into the blood and stuff. Jesus, if he's the creator God, he knows that. It's just that he's trying to help us understand that ultimately, the food doesn't touch the center of our personhood. Now, as a lover of pork crackling and Australian crayfish, this is great news. And Mark puts the little, they put it in brackets because I think Mark kind of added this after the events. In saying this, Jesus declared all foods clean. Woohoo! All foods are clean. All those Jewish laws about food, what you can and can't eat, changed. Now I think this is amazing. It's amazing. There's an amazing liberation here. It means that suddenly things like, for people who are followers of Jesus and Christians, and I guess for all people, suddenly the world is your oyster, literally. But also, suddenly things like alcohol or, you know, medication, things like cocaine, marijuana, all these things that are part of the good creation can be used for good. They're available for us to do good. Now, how we use them, we need to think hard about that. But they're suddenly available. I'm just going to cover the... I didn't say that. It's incredibly liberating. For so much of the world, people's holiness is determined by the outside. But it's not just in the area of religion, isn't it? People find their value by the way the outside affects them. Who do they spend time with? What are their peers like? I'm valued according to my peers. Because why? The outside affects you. The value of my house, the value of my income, all these things. If I'm in poverty, then I must be, it's an external thing. I must be less valuable. That's the way our world thinks. But not just in the area of food, but in every external thing. This is not what makes us clean or unclean. Oh no, the uncleanness comes from the heart. And the heart has problems. It can't be corrupted by food because it's already corrupted. See his words there? For it is from within. Jesus said in sentence 20, what comes out of a person is what defiles them, for it is from within, out of a person's heart, that evil thoughts come. The problem with hearts being hearts far from God is that they are no longer good. Their starting point is they're not good. They are factories that produce corruption. So the problem isn't outside, it's inside. And what comes out? Evil thoughts, immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, malice, deceitness, lewd, envy, slander, arrogance, and folly. All these come from inside and make a man unclean. And suddenly we find ourselves tainted. For some of us, I think this list actually ought to hit like a ton of bricks. We have stolen. We have committed adultery. We have had evil thoughts. We have engaged in sexual immorality. This is what our society and culture is like. What's just kind of broken open on the news recently? Well, Adam Goods. And then Eddie Maguire. Showing his heart is what? So broken that he can't even control his speech on national radio. Well, what about the social media? At the moment, I was on news.com it kind of gives you a snap summary, you know, 21st century postmodern view of all the news. It's only one web page long. Articles are 400 pages. Perfect for a lack of depth. But what currently, there's a bunch of things going around called FB rape, Facebook rape. And it's pointing out that Facebook allows misogynistic groups to exist. All sorts of groups exist. And there's a picture, a terrible image, of this woman who's been beaten up. And it's a picture of her, and it's from one of these misogynistic groups. This woman, have I got that right way around? Misogynistic. Yeah, woman hating groups, yep. And it said, it says, I wanted to look at the slide. It says something like, if she didn't want to look like this, she should have answered this question the first time. And it's just rife on the internet. Our anonymity just allows our human heart to bubble out, and evil thoughts become evil expressions. Maybe that's not your experience. You don't have time for Facebook. But what about the corporate environment? Here's a quote from KPMG on fraud released earlier this year or end of last year. Here's a quote from it. Fraud committed by people within in an organisation is the people you tend to trust. That's who does fraud in the companies. The people you trust. Over the last 2 years, $373 million have been lost to fraud, and that is just the tip of the iceberg because people don't report it, or are afraid to report it, or companies are afraid to own up to it. They'd rather keep it hidden in their balance sheet. And how does this work? Who commits this fraud? Well, let me tell you some statistics and answer that question. Companies who had under 100 people, well, only 9% of those had reported fraud. Companies with under 100 people. If a company had 100 to 500 people, well, 31% of those businesses experienced fraud. But if companies had 500 plus people, then 45% of those businesses experienced fraud. Who commits this fraud? Well, whoever can get away with it. The bigger the company, the more opportunity, the less accountability, the more complexity, and therefore, the more fraud. Who commits it? Whoever can get away with it. Now, we should just stop for a moment because 36% of these fraudsters admit that they were motivated by personal financial pressure. But if we were really good, would a motivation by financial pressure, our own personal financial pressure, justify taking from a company and creating financial pressure somewhere else? If we were really good, it wouldn't, would it? And by the way, what about the other 74%? We're motivated just by plain greed. Are we really good? But for some of us, we might look at a list like this and say, well, I've never murdered anyone, nor I've committed adultery, nor fraud. I've never racially abused anyone. I haven't been a troll on social media. Sure, I've experienced some greed and some malice and a little bit of envy. The point is, Jesus says, if you've experienced any of those things, what you need to know is where it came from. If you experience them, it's because it came from within. You might have less issues than some people, but you've got issues. See, we don't have a clean heart or a good heart. A good heart doesn't envy. A good heart doesn't feel malice and then justify the malice. A good heart doesn't do anything on the bus and then call the other person who didn't do anything on the bus a ... coward. A good heart wouldn't slander. A good heart wouldn't delight in lewdness. A good heart wouldn't be foolish or uncaring or walk right past someone because you're busy, or walk right past a child, or walk right past a bleeding child. A good heart wouldn't be neglectful nor worried about its own mortgage more than the homeless on the street. A good heart wouldn't be more worried about the career than the career of its colleagues. A good heart wouldn't be happy to see people wronged and for them to get away with it as long as it doesn't affect us. Your heart and my heart has issues. If we've done these things and felt these things and thought these things, our hearts must not be good. They must be far away from God. It's a truth we've got to come to. Why is it so hard to be good? because we're not good. Our default option is rejection of the good, holy and perfect God. And so we are, to use very Christian language, unholy. Jesus says that you are unclean. That means not fit for God. Paul, the Apostle Paul, he wrote big slabs in the New Testament, put it like this in Romans chapter 7. I do not understand what I do. For what I want to do, I do not do. But what I hate, I do. A little bit later he says, I know that nothing good lives in me, that is in my sinful nature. For I have the desire to do what is good, but I cannot carry it out. For what I do is not the good I want to do. No, the evil I do, that I do not want to do, this evil, I keep on doing. Well, that's the problem. What is the solution? Well, let me sketch it for you in a minute, which is hardly satisfactory. But if the heart is broken, if the center is corrupt, if we cannot fix ourselves, if we cannot, by definition, lift ourselves up by our own bootstraps, because the people holding the boots are corrupted, we need someone to rescue us. And as we work our way through Mark's gospel, Jesus says this, referring to himself, the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve. To do good. And what was that great goodness? To give his life as a ransom for many. A ransom, a rescue. A rescue out of badness, out of evil, out of brokenness, out of corruption. How would he rescue us? His clean, pure heart that never knew evil, or the intention of evil, was stopped on the cross. He was killed by evil, wicked men, but he also gave up his life so that we could be rescued, we could be ransomed from our very own hearts. And then Jesus, when he rose from the dead, was resurrected and ascended into heaven, said, I know that you by your own hearts cannot follow me. So I'll send my spirit to give you a new heart, a new heart. And this was Jesus' promise to all who follow him. What is the solution to our broken hearts? It's not found in us. It's found outside of us. But not by religious rules or regulations or institutions. But by a person. The Creator God. See, the solution is not found by denying there is a problem. The solution is found by recognizing there is a problem. Next time we have an evil thought, we have to face up to the fact that it is an evil thought. Because only then will we look to Jesus for our rescue and our ransom. And that's what he promised to do, to give a new heart. And not just to people as individuals, but to a bunch of individuals so that then with new hearts they could serve other individuals and create a community, to create a marketplace where children wouldn't be knocked down and driven over by delivery vans. And we wouldn't walk past because our shopping was more important than a dying child. Jesus thinks we've got issues, but will we face the fact that our hearts have issues?